Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. You're listening to the Project 2025 What's in It podcast, a special series from KALW Public Media about the far right's agenda outlined in what they're calling Project 2025 Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out a comprehensive agenda to transform the United States into a conservative Christian nation under Donald Trump. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. One note before we dig in. When this show originally aired live on KALW, we took calls and emails. If you have a comment or perspective to share, email us at project2025@kalw.org. Today, we continue our series on Project 2025 by discussing the damage it would cause to the climate and our planet. This section of Project 2025 is incredibly important because climate scientists like Dr. Kimberly Nicholas say if we cut global carbon emissions in half by 2030 and then zero by 2040, we have a 2 in 3 chance to stabilize warming at around 1.5 degrees Celsius. We are living through the decade that will define the future for both humanity and life on Earth. The next president will determine whether we take action. We do not have time to wait another 4 years. Today's guest, Grist reporter Zoya Tierstein, writes that if the policies laid out in Project 2025 are implemented, it will be extremely difficult for the United States to fulfill the climate goals it has committed to under the 2015 Paris Agreement. Those policies include privatizing NOAA and the National Weather Service, opening the floodgates for oil and gas drilling, and repealing significant sources of climate funding in policies like the Inflation Reduction Act. Zoya Tierstein is staff writer for Grist. Zoya has covered what Project 2025 would do to climate policy in the U.S. She's also leading Grist's new newsletter, Disaster on the Ballot, which looks at how experiences with extreme weather fueled by climate change is shaping the way people vote. Hi, Zoya. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Union of Concerned Scientists, Rachel Cletus, says Project 2025 takes aim at the federal government's ability to address the climate crisis and instead doubles down on actions to worsen it. Rachel Cletus is policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Rachel wrote an article titled Project 2025 would be disastrous for our nation and our climate. And you can find these articles at kalw.org, click news, and then Your Call. Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'd love to start by talking about the importance of this section in Project 2025, given the fact that we don't have time to address the climate crisis. I just think this deserves so much more attention in the media because, of course, we should have taken action years ago, but here's where we are. We just don't have time. Rachel, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're in a very profound moment here where we can see the reality of the climate crisis all around us in the wildfires, the intensified hurricanes, the flooding, the extreme heat waves. And that's just this summer all around our nation. And it's true around the world. So this is not about some distant future. The crisis is here. It's at our doorstep. And we know what the underlying cause is. It's burning fossil fuels primarily. So Project 2025 is particularly disruptive because it not only denies the reality that's here and now, but also undermines our efforts to address it going forward.
And Rachel, I think about how things are framed during this election, and we always hear that this election will determine the future of democracy in the United States, which of course is true. But this election will also determine whether we take action on the climate crisis.
Yes, yeah, scientists have repeatedly called this the decisive decade for climate action. And the reason for that is because global heat-trapping emissions are continuing to rise. We're continuing to see fossil fuels expand, even as we know we're running out of atmospheric space, and we're flirting very closely to that line of 1.5°C. And we know that the impacts, even now at a little over 1.2 degrees Celsius, are already pretty dramatic and harmful and deadly and costly. So we just really have to accelerate our action to limit further extreme climate impacts. And this is good for us. It's good for the economy. It's good for public health. It's in all of our best interest to do this. Clean energy is not just good for dealing with the climate crisis. It helps clean up air and water pollution that's killing people today. So the idea that we would put it our heads in the sand and deny the reality of the science instead of acting on it and acting with urgency, that just flies in the face of common sense, and it's against the interest, the broader public interest. But you know who it does serve? It serves the fossil fuel industry's interests if we continue to burn fossil fuels. And that's what this whole enterprise is about. It's about propping up the interests of the rich and powerful and the fossil fuel industry and its allies.
Zoya, you write about these issues for Grist. You regularly interview climate scientists and experts. What would you like to add?
Well, I think the first thing I'd add is just that, you know, you mentioned it as a section in Project 2025, but in fact, and of course you know this, it actually permeates the environment and climate repercussions in this document permeate every aspect of the blueprint. I mean, it's in every section. So, the Project 2025 architects, you know, they recommend eliminating climate and environment policies from almost every aspect of government and fundamentally restructuring the government too, to make everything sort of fit in different places. And so the long-term repercussions on climate and environment policy in the US would be astounding, frankly. And I will note just as a caveat that, you know, Donald Trump has distanced himself from Project 2025. As many have noted, you know, it's not a guarantee that all of these policies will in fact be incorporated into a second Trump term if that is to happen. But it is safe to say that some portion of them will likely feature front and center. I mean, that's what happened during his first term. About 64% of the policy recommendations proposed by the Heritage Foundation, which is of course wrote Project 2025, were incorporated into Trump's first term in some regard, either implemented or considered. So I think my input on this is that there are some pretty fundamental shifts to not just climate and environment policy, but the way that the federal government fundamentally functions that have repercussions for climate policy in the U.S.
Right. And we've done shows about that in our Project 2025 series. It would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. The plan is to fire over 50,000 civil servants and then replace them with MAGA loyalists. And you can listen to our past shows about how they plan to do this specifically by going to KALW.org, click on news, and then your call. So as you said, Zoya, it does permeate the entire Project 2025. Given the work that you do, and given that you have talked to so many people about what Project 2025 would do specifically on climate and the planet, what really stands out for you the most? I mean, there's so many aspects here, but what strikes you the most?
Oh yeah, there's so much to choose from. I mean, it's a huge document, right? Which is what's also puzzling, because the GOP platform, which is normally where you'd go for some more concrete clues about what, you know, a future presidential term, Republican presidential term might look like, is very small. So there's just a few things really in there comparatively. But there are echoes. So really, when you compare the two documents, the GOP platform and Project 25, you see some things fall out. And I think the main thing that you see come out of that is this drill, baby, drill sort of ethos. So it's really about unleashing, in their words, in the words of actually both platforms, America's energy resources. So I think what you can expect from that, and this is imbued throughout the document, the blueprint, which is, you know, upwards of 800 pages, is, you know, opening up public lands for drilling, offshore drilling. You have limiting, you know, federal agencies' capacity to monitor such drilling activities. They're limiting their capacity to track how those activities affect climate change. And then you have some more sort of interesting and unexpected and frankly puzzling moves in there, such as moving FEMA, which obviously responds to disasters and writes checks to states following major disasters like hurricanes. They want to move that out from the Department of Homeland Security and move it under perhaps the Department of Transportation. And it's unclear what effect that would have or why that's even something that, you know, the Heritage Foundation would want to support. You also have efforts to sort of gut the federal government's abilities to track weather, for example. And it's interesting, there are some contradictions in there as well. For example, they recommend getting rid of NOAA's, you know, climate science capabilities and weather tracking abilities, but they want to keep the Hurricane Center, the Hurricane Forecasting Center intact. But that center relies on data from NOAA to function. So a lot of these things just don't make sense.
Well, and to your point about drill, baby, drill, I mean, Donald Trump says the top two things he's going to do if he wins is to begin a mass deportation plan on day one. And then the second thing is drill, baby, drill. Rachel, what about you? What really stands out for you in this massive document?
Well, I want to start by saying the Union of Concerned Scientists is a nonpartisan organization. This is not about politics. It really is about going after facts and science. And that's what's really alarming about this document. It's trying to take on this very dark ages type of approach to what science and what scientists are doing to contribute to our well-being. So take the example of NOAA that was just discussed. This science is actionable science. It's science that's life-saving, not just the hurricane alerts and the work that they do and the science underlying that, but everything around the extreme weather we're seeing, like extended heat waves. We all check those weather forecasts, and most of the weather forecasts we're seeing, the underlying data they're drawing on is coming from NOAA. We're looking at things like, oh, the heat dome, it's in this part of the country, it's going to be here for this many days, it's going to move over from the west to the east. All of us have been engaged in tracking these weather patterns this summer. We understand that it's literally life-saving to know what's going to come our way. And then it's not just about weather that's occurring right now, it's also about looking out into the future and seeing, based on how our climate is warming, what can we expect in the future? Just today, NOAA has released its annual high tide flooding outlook, for example, and this is talking about sunny day flooding, which is worsening because of accelerating sea level rise. Sea level rise is accelerating, it's driven by climate change, and we're now seeing regularly around the country, even without storms, the amount of high tide flooding accelerate along the eastern Gulf Coast of the US. And this NOAA prediction is just talking about how much more we can expect in this coming year. And for folks who live in coastal communities, this is the kind of forecast that you rely on to think about your critical infrastructure, your roads, your homes, all of the things in the path of this kind of flooding. And it's going after the people, the staffing, the budgets that we all rely on to do their work in a science-based way so that they can protect our health and well-being. Work that EPA does to make sure that we understand what chemicals in our environment are affecting our health. How can we limit that pollution so that we can protect people's health? And one thing that's really insidious about this is we know that these impacts, health impacts, climate impacts, are disproportionately borne by communities of color, by low-income folks, by folks who are marginalized in a lot of different ways. And therefore, not only is this an attack in general, it is an attack that will have an outsized impact on people who have been long marginalized in our country. Yeah, and I think, you know, for example, one of these ideas of dismantling the staffing and the agency budgets, this is just, it's a willful attack on the ability of agencies to deliver on their mission. EPA's mission to protect our health and the environment, or NOAA's science mission. This is just setting us back. It is literally shooting ourselves in the foot instead of acting on the science and the information that's available. And all of the idea that we would turn this all over to industry interests, industries that have their profits in mind, they're not thinking about the welfare of people at large. They want to extract as much fossil fuels as possible, pollute as much as possible, and pass on those costs to society at large. So as a nation, we've always known that the best balance we can have is when we have a strong regulatory health-based framework together with private sector interests that are producing products we all use and enjoy. They're producing products that are innovative. But to have this untrammeled ability to just pollute the environment, that is not helpful to anyone. And there is very, very important work that's being done across federal agencies to make sure that that is not the case.
Rachel Cletus is Policy Director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We're also joined by Zoya Tierstein, staff writer for GRIST. They both have written about Project 2025, and today we continue our series on Project 2025 by discussing the damage it would cause to the climate and our planet. If you have any questions for our guests about Project 2025 and what it calls for, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. GRIST reporter Zoya Tierstein writes that if the policies laid out in Project 2025 are implemented, it will be extremely difficult for the United States to fulfill the climate goals it's committed to under the Paris Agreement that was committed to in 2015. So can you talk more about that, Zoya? Because of course, when that happened, it got international attention. And, so tell us what experts are pointing to in Project 2025 that would make it extremely difficult for the United States to meet those goals.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, even that blueprint aside, there has been an independent analysis by Carbon Brief that found that a second Trump term would add 400 billion metric tons of greenhouse gas emissions, additional greenhouse gas emissions, which is the equivalent of Japan's and the European Union's economies or emissions outputs combined annually. So we're looking at, if Trump is elected a second time based on, policies that have been suggested outside of Project 2025, I mean, that this is outside of the blueprint. The U.S. will be looking at a much higher emissions profile than, if a Democrat were to take office. So there's that. I mean, that's the first thing to note. Within Project 2025, there are a number of policies and different recommendations that would fundamentally change the way the U.S. manages its public lands, for example, or the way that it allows offshore drilling, that kind of thing. So basically, if you look at the blueprint as a whole, you can just see that the overall, and I already mentioned this, but the overall overarching kind of ethos is to unleash American energy resources, which is something that the GOP has been calling for a long time and that is in many respects already happening across the U.S. But Project 25 advocates for more of that. So basically allowing all of the nation's natural gas resources to be tapped and to, pivot away from this existing Biden administration policy around climate change, which has been relatively aggressive. I mean, we could talk about that more, but mm-hmm. the Biden administration has passed sort of a landmark climate investment bill that directs a lot of money incentives towards renewable energy development, that kind of thing. So if Trump were to take office, and this is something that's said in Project 25, unrolling all that progress would potentially be a top priority. Now, whether they would be able to actually do that or not is unclear. A lot of this money is already out of the gate. A lot of Republican states are already embracing some of these investments and don't necessarily want those investments to go away because they create jobs. So how much of that can really be rolled back is unclear. But in general, a president who would take this blueprint under advisement and implement, even any small portion of it, would be looking at, an emissions profile that's higher than it would be if the opposite were true.
Rachel, in your piece, you write, in an appalling twist on reality, Project 2025 includes a call to, quote, stop the war on oil and natural gas, when in fact it is big oil and gas corporations that are waging a war on our climate and health. So tell us more about what you call the polluting fossil fueled energy agenda.
Yeah, look, the reality is that right now in the United States, we're producing record amounts of oil and fossil gas, all-time highs, and our emissions are still rising, and global heat-trapping emissions are still rising. The idea that the whole world came together, recognized a problem, recognized the source of it, and made this commitment that we would collectively address this problem, because it's in all our self-interest. That is what we're losing sight of here. This is not about an agenda that's being foisted on the United States. This is in our best interest, because we can see the devastation around us. We're seeing these billion-dollar plus extreme weather and climate disasters mount across our nation. We're seeing people suffer. We have to get our arms around this. So in the face of that, what we've seen the fossil fuel industry do was over decades engage in a campaign of lies at first about the climate science. And when the science has become increasingly undeniable and the reality is undeniable, they've shifted to this a way of spreading misinformation and using delay as a tactic. They are still lobbying heavily against any kind of robust climate policy. And they are still looking for any opportunity to expand fossil fuels, which is continuing right now, as I mentioned, in this current political environment as well. So we have to very quickly turn this around. At the UN climate talks last year, nations agreed to phase out fossil fuels and start to take decisive action in this decade. What the United States does in terms of limiting the expansion of fossil fuels is going to be hugely consequential, not just for the United States, but for the whole world. And obviously, we have to act in concert with other nations, including China, the European Union, other nations as well. But if we continue to expand fossil fuels, we are just fueling a disaster for the whole world. And we're destroying our own backyard, not just through climate impacts, but through all of the other environmental harms and health harms that fossil fuels cause. The power of the fossil fuel industry is incredible in the United States, and it has had a huge hold over our politics. And it's time to hold them accountable. It is time to put a stop to this agenda of expansion of fossil fuels. And we have a huge opportunity here, because clean energy costs are coming down all the time. Clean energy, wind, solar, energy storage, these are the energy forms of today that are already new forms of this energy are already cheaper than legacy fossil fuels in most places in the world. This is what we should be investing in expanding. And the Inflation Reduction Act has made a really significant investment in accelerating that clean energy momentum. And as Zoya was pointing out, the benefits are flowing to red states and blue states. In fact, just in the last day, we've seen a number of Republican lawmakers send a letter to Speaker Johnson saying that they wanted those clean energy tax credits to be preserved because it is delivering economic benefits in their constituencies. So this reality that clean energy is getting cheaper, it is a huge economic opportunity. It can create jobs here in the United States and is creating jobs right now. So why are we attached to the fossil fuels? It is because of the outside influence of the fossil fuel industry.
Zoya, before we go to break, can you talk about the influence of the fossil fuel industry? Are you seeing any changes? We often point to the Washington Post piece by Josh Dossi and Maxine Joselow that came out in May, called What Trump Promised Oil CEOs as He Asked Them to Steer $1 Billion to His Campaign. And they start the piece by writing, as Donald Trump sat with some of the country's top oil executives at his Mar-a-Lago club last month, so that'd be April, one executive complained about how they continued to face burdensome environmental regulations despite spending $400 million to lobby the Biden administration in the last year. I mean, to think that they spent $400 million just on lobbying the Biden administration in a year. So can you talk about the power they have, and is that changing at all?
It's such a good question. And to answer it, I have to go back in time a little bit, because the history of how fossil fuel companies have influenced American climate policy is decades long. If you look back to about the 1970s, there was a time when climate change and the fact that climate change was happening and that humans were contributing to it was relatively apolitical. You had politicians on both sides of the aisle realizing that this was going to be a problem. Then what you see sort of a decade after that, or maybe a little bit more, is fossil fuel companies sort of organizing this united front to get Republican politicians to sort of deny. And you can see over time, the denial has not stuck so much because of the, you know, sheer visceral effect of climate change now in some respect. But delay has become just as valid, and it's just as effective in many ways as denial, because it just delays, aggressive action. And to oil companies, whose number one mission is to continue, you know, digging up and selling the number one product that has made them so much money over this these many years, the goal is to keep doing that. Now, what you'll see with a lot of oil companies is this pivot to other forms of other ways to describe what they're doing. And some of these are, you know, semi-legit, and most are wholly not. So, for example, ExxonMobil several years back, and I covered this for Grist back when I started working for the company in 2018, decided to focus on algae as a biofuel. And if you looked at their social media sites, Facebook, Twitter at the time, it looked like algae was the number one thing they were working on. It was permeating everything that they did. And when I called the company's headquarters to talk to their algae division, the person there said she never heard of any such thing, which is, you know, indicative of how many of these major fossil fuel companies think about their renewable energy portfolio. They spend a lot of money and a lot of energy saying they're working on carbon capture, on renewable energies, when in fact it makes up just a very tiny, tiny portion of their portfolio. And of course, the number one interest and business strategy is to focus on oil, and now to a large extent plastics. So I think the way that fossil fuel companies have influenced American politics is uniquely profound in the United States. You can see it elsewhere in the world, but here, you know, it's a very hard thing to sort of separate one from the other.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Zoya Tierstein, staff writer for Zist. Zoya has covered what Project 2025 would do to climate policy in the United States. She's also leading Grist's new newsletter, Disaster on the Ballot, which looks at how experiences with extreme weather fueled by the climate crisis is shaping the way people vote. Rachel Cletus is policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Rachel wrote a piece called Project 2025 Would Be Disastrous for Our Nation and Our Climate. And today we continue our series on Project 2025 by discussing the damage it would cause to the climate and our planet. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we continue our series on Project 2025. It's a Heritage Foundation-led plan that lays out a comprehensive agenda to transform the United States into a conservative Christian nation for the next Republican president and what they call Trumpism. It would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers, eliminating federal agencies, and firing more than 50,000 civil servants and replacing them with MAGA loyalists. You can find all of our shows at kalw.org, click news, and then Your Call. Today, we're talking about the plan's damage it would cause to the climate and our planet. Zoya Tierstein is staff writer for Grist. Rachel Cletus is policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Let's hear from a caller, Isabella in Yountville. Hi, Isabella. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Yes, Rose, thank you for always having a great show, a lot better than the mainstream TV.
Thank you.
So what I'm wondering is, when Kamala and Tim win the presidency, I want to know about Project 25 as far as how far can the right wing go. So if Trump got it, then of course Project 25 would be all over the place. Well, now that Kamala and Tim are going to take it, without question, where does Project 25 go?
Ah, okay. Thank you for that. We have a related question from Ted, who agrees with you and says Democrats stand a decent chance of keeping the White House this November, but we know the right never sleeps. Heritage and its wealthy funders will stay busy and continue their machinations. Are Democrats, progressives, and their allies formulating a plan to continue the fight against the right after November? Never too soon to start brainstorming on this. So thank you for those questions. Rachel, what are your thoughts on this? If Kamala Harris becomes president in November, what happens to Project 2025 and its plans for the future of our planet?
Well, as I said, we're a nonpartisan organization, so I'm not going to comment on specific candidates and their agendas. But what I can say is that the underlying concern here is that this is a very long-running trend that goes beyond any particular presidential cycle. The outsized influence of the fossil fuel industry on our politics, that is a decades-long enterprise here. As I was just starting to lay out, you know, the fossil fuel industry has known the harm that its products would cause for decades. In fact, their own internal memos show that, dating back to the late 70s and early 80s. And they proceeded to lie about it, bury the facts, and continue to expand their product. So this is a trend we should all be worried about, getting the fossil fuel industry out of our politics and making sure that we hold them accountable. That is the job of it's the job of the hour. And it's sort of regardless of who wins the presidency, we have to do this because we're still seeing fossil fuels expand. The other piece that's just to recognize is that the courts have turned increasingly hostile. And so a lot of actions that are being taken to address climate change are increasingly being taken to court. And that delay is costly because when you have important standards and regulations tied up in court proceedings for years, even if they ultimately win out and the agencies can move forward, we've lost precious time. And so, for example, the EPA is moving now on power plant carbon standards. Already, the lawsuits are starting to get filed against it. And this is the kind of trend, again, that we've seen where industry interests, as soon as there's any health protective standard, whether it's vehicle standards or power plant standards or any other standard to hold polluting industries accountable, immediately get taken to court. And in this current court environment, with a very hostile Supreme Court on many of these issues, that is also going to create a serious challenge regardless of who wins the presidency. So I think there are broader trends here that anyone who cares about our democracy and who wants policy to be informed by good science, wants people to be able to do their jobs in federal agencies to help protect us and move our country forward, need to really keep their eye on, really be aware that it's not simply about an election, it is about these underlying trends. As well, what's happening at the grassroots and the state level, that's very, very important. You know, obviously, election cycles at the national level do command a great degree of attention. But there are many serious, important trends that we need to pay attention to in our own states, our own communities, in our backyards, where people are trying to either move progress forward or are getting thwarted in moving forward policies and investments that would move us towards clean energy, create a more equitable transition, ensure that we're reducing pollution and addressing climate change, building resilience to extreme climate impacts that are developing. There's a role at every level of government, and that is also something that we have to keep our eye on.
Zoya, what would you like to add? One of the themes that has come up in our Project 2025 shows is that even if Trump does not win in November, a lot of these policies could be or already being implemented at the state levels. So what would you like to add?
Yeah, well, I think Rachel covered the main takeaways. I think that something that's worth noting is that it's very, very hard to get climate policy passed in this country. I mean, the Biden administration came in with a giant multi-trillion-dollar plan focused really primarily on climate change. And somehow, sort of on a wing and a prayer, Biden got, you know, a version of that, a much weaker version, but a historic version nonetheless, passed. He called it the Inflation Reduction Act, though, of course, or rather Democrats did, which is indicative, right? Because it seems as though the American public is not yet still clamoring for, you know, a massive climate bill called, you know, the Let's Bring Emissions Down Act. You know, in fact, the focus is still on inflation, on jobs, on the economy, as it always is, you know, especially before a big election. So I think, you know, if Kamala Harris is to be elected, her and Walz have sort of a big job cut out for them. Now, I think that what may be heartening to the person who asked this question initially is that Tim Walz has a great record on climate change in Minnesota. And there's a lot that can be done at the state level. It's not just, you know, rolling back climate policies. Under Trump, a lot of governors passed very aggressive climate legislation. So there's tons to be done. I think the hardest part may be getting another climate bill passed at the federal level.
Well, to your point, a number of climate groups like the Sunrise Movement even have celebrated Kamala Harris's choice of Tim Walz as her vice president. So thank you for the question, Isabella, and thank you for the email, Tim. We'll get back to calls in a minute, but I do want to talk about what Project 2025 means for climate science. To think, Rachel, there are so many people who work in government who've been there for decades, who have dedicated their lives to various departments like the EPA, for example, or NOAA. And they do the work that people need to figure out how is the climate really changing. I mean, you need decades of work to find these answers. So as you write, Project 2025 includes attacks on NOAA, the National Weather Service, the U.S. Global Change Research Program. What would this mean for climate science and the people who work in these agencies?
You know, ignorance will never help us in addressing the big challenges of the day. So this idea that we would willfully want to keep ourselves ignorant of science and facts doesn't serve anyone except people who are trying to bury those inconvenient truths and are trying to advance their own narrow self-interest. So the U.S. Global Change Research Program, for example, this is a interagency effort to over a cycle of every 5 to 6 years, provides an updated assessment of the latest science. It is not a political document. It's not a policy prescriptive document. It's basically giving us the best available science that then we can go use in all the different ways that it's important to use it to make plans to how to address it. The document itself is not a political or policy document. And it is really bizarre that Project 2025 wants to dismantle or change somehow this effort, which, by the way, is authorized through an act of Congress. The U.S. GCRP is tasked by Congress under the 1990 Global Change Research Act to do this work. So this is essentially thwarting the will of Congress. Congress has passed a law. Scientists are simply delivering on what the law calls for. And now all of a sudden it's being called an agenda, climate alarmism, all kinds of, you know, throwaway lines like that, which just do not reflect the reality. Similarly, the Clean Air Act is being attacked. The National Environmental Policy Act, which is a bedrock environmental protection in our country, by the way, passed, signed into law by President Nixon in 1970. These are acts of Congress, and federal agencies are then tasked with delivering and implementing these acts. The Inflation Reduction Act, it's an act of Congress. Now we have a number of agencies that are working very hard to implement it the way the act was lawfully written in statute. So it would really undermine our democracy if Congress passes laws like this and agencies are simply delivering on the mission, and then they're being singled out and targeted by a completely political agenda that's motivated by fossil fuel interests. So this is so blatant that I think anybody, you don't even have to be thinking about climate. Anyone looking at this should say, this is an attack on our democracy. This is an attack on the fundamental apparatus that we all rely on, that laws once passed by Congress will be implemented, and agencies will do their part in implementing them. these staff people who are working at EPA, NOAA, DOE, these are all Korea staff who are simply doing their job and are now being targeted for it. That's a very, very chilling effect on the ability of them to do their job, on morale. And when you have entire agencies under assault like this, if people get fired and laid off and budgets get cut, it is very hard to build back from that wreckage. So not only in that moment in time do we all suffer, but it takes so much time to build back from that, to come back from that kind of an assault. This is very detrimental, this kind of just willful attacks on agencies just doing their job.
And to talk more a bit about these agencies, Zoya, you write that within the Department of Energy, offices dedicated to clean energy research and implementation would be eliminated, and energy efficiency guidelines and requirements for household appliances would be scrapped. The environmental oversight capacities of the Department of the Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency would be curbed significantly or eliminated altogether, preventing these agencies from tracking methane emissions, managing environmental pollutants and chemicals, and climate change research. And Zoya, this is really interesting. You report that in addition to these major overhauls, Project 2025 also advocates for getting rid of smaller and lesser known federal programs and statutes that safeguard public health and environmental justice. Can you tell us about a few of those?
Oh, certainly. And this is actually something that I spoke to Rachel about when I interviewed her for this article. But there are a number of smaller issues. And Rachel, of course, you should jump in if you have anything to add, because you are an authority on this. But the blueprint recommends eliminating the endangerment finding. So it's the legal mechanism that requires the EPA to curb emissions and air pollutants from vehicles and power plants, among other things, under the Clean Air Act. It also recommends axing government efforts to assess the social cost of carbon or the damage each additional ton of carbon emitted causes. And it also seeks to prevent agencies from overseeing or assessing the co-benefits, or, you know, a better way to put that is the knock-on positive health impacts of their policies. So, you know, a policy that reduces emissions might also produce better air quality, but the policies in this document would prevent federal agencies from actually assessing those benefits.
And Rachel, you told Zoya that when you think about who's going to be hit the hardest by pollution, it's often very low-income communities and communities of color. And this is really important to point out because in the beginning of your piece, Rachel, you point out that the document is littered with harmful mischaracterizations and attacks against the rights of Black, Brown, and Indigenous people, women, LGBTQ+ people, people forced to migrate, and more. So tell us more about how this would really affect frontline communities.
Yeah, so the reality in our nation is that what we're seeing today is the legacy of a very, very long time of racism, of colonialism, of structural inequities that have cast a very long shadow. And there is a lot of science that proves this, as well as people's lived experiences, of course, that underscore this. We know that when we look at air pollution data, when we look at where toxic sites are located, when we look at communities that are overburdened by pollution, overwhelmingly, they're more likely to be low-income communities, more likely to be communities of color, Indigenous communities, Black and Brown communities. And if we don't recognize this reality and we just move forward as if this did not exist, we're not going to actually address the underlying concerns here. And those concerns are that people have a higher health burden, are dying at higher rates because of this accumulated pollution in their communities. Now, the thing about fossil fuels is climate change, which is this huge global crisis right now. This is just the latest manifestation of harms from the fossil fuel industry and from fossil fuels. It starts from the extraction of fossil fuels and what it has done to the environment of communities that live near it. The burning of fossil fuels, so harmful for people's health. The economic exploitation that's been at the heart of the fossil fuel industry, where some people make huge profits and others are barely getting by, their livelihoods are so precarious. And they're often taking on some of the most dangerous jobs in the world. Think about coal mining. So these are people, you know, who are have been deliberately in a system marginalized and exposed to higher risks from the fossil fuel industry. And there is very good science showing that the when we're trying to tackle these problems, we have to understand the cumulative burden of pollution in communities from the multiple sources that the communities are exposed to and really address that, because that is how the human body is experiencing the harms. It's not simply, oh, there's climate change here today, and oh, there's asthma tomorrow, and oh, there's some heart condition. It's all happening at the same time in these communities. And some of the really important policy progress that we can make right now through initiatives like the Justice 40 initiative, which has been implemented by the current administration to help ensure that at least 40% of the benefits of federal investments are going to communities that have been marginalized. This kind of a proactive approach is what we need, because to set right this historical harm, we have to very intentionally make sure we're prioritizing communities for both cleaning up pollution as well as the investments and the economic opportunities to thrive in a cleaner energy economy. And so that's why, you know, the science on this is also very clear, just as clear as the science on climate change. The public health science on overburdened communities and the connection with race and wealth and income, it's in the literature, it's undeniable. So let's have policies that actually start from those facts, and let's not deny those facts. It is a real fact, and it's not appropriate in our policymaking environment not to start with the fact that some people are being worse affected. So their very pressing needs, their urgent needs, must be addressed as we deal with the broader concerns.
Well, we have a number of callers that came in close to the end of the show, so we'll try to get to all of them. If you can be brief, and then we will get our guests to respond. Let's go to Doe in Berkeley. Hi, Doe.
Hi. I wanted to, first of all, I love your show.
Thank you.
Biden is just as guilty as Trump is when it comes to environment. He swore up and down he wasn't going to drill in federal land. And we see what happened in Willow up in Alaska. The fear is so deep. I think that it's deeper than just Republicans and Democrats. It's corporate, and we're a corporate country. What about weather engineering as well? And then also war. We're funding war, and that is a great environmental destruction.
Well, thank you for the comments. During Biden's tenure, the United States has continued to produce and export the most crude oil out of any country at any time, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. I'm just reading from ABC there. Thank you for that comment, and we're definitely going to do shows about Biden and climate. Let's go next to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS.
Thank you so much. Hello, Rose. This is GS up in South Lake Tahoe. Two things I'd like to add to this discussion are things. The first is something I've called about before. We absolutely must repeal Citizens United. We have got to get the money out of politics. If we don't do this, we're doomed. So that's sort of obvious still, but I bring it up again. And the other thing is I think we absolutely must expand the number of justices in our Supreme Court. Right now, our previous dangerous president managed to get three justices placed on the Supreme Court, and it's now there's a hardcore conservative majority that's just driving us into the ground. And so I really would like to see us expand the number of justices in the Supreme Court beyond what it is now to at least 13, so that and to have the justices have term limits of like 16 or 18 years or something.
Well, thank you, GS. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. We'll definitely do a show about that. And then, of course, money and politics. This election is expected to once again break records. We don't have time for our other callers, but Greg in Palo Alto says, what is it going to take for the world to deal with the climate crisis? So I know that's a huge question. I don't want to throw that at our guests, but final thoughts from both of you about to bring this back to where we started, just the fact that we don't have time. We don't have another 4 years to deal with this. So, Rachel, what are your thoughts about really where we are and, you know, how to make this a little more, I guess, palatable to people who don't really know the science behind climate change? They know something's not right, but they're not really sure why this is happening.
So the core science here is that climate change is touching practically every aspect of our lives, our economy, our health, and the underlying cause is burning fossil fuels. So all of us need to be advocating for policies and policymakers to address this issue, hold fossil fuel companies accountable, transition to clean energy quickly, and really phase out fossil fuels. Your vote is important. Really think about it, not just at the federal level, but at the local level in your state. Your vote really counts. And so showing up, making sure that our democracy is strong, is crucial for addressing any problem, including climate change.
Thank you for that. Zoya, what would you like to add? Final thoughts? We have about a minute left.
I'll just say quickly that, you know, politics, climate change doesn't always factor into how voters think at the ballot box, but disasters often do, climate disasters. And Grist has a limited run newsletter launching, actually just launched our first edition yesterday, about called State of Emergency, about how climate disasters shape political life. And so if you want to learn more about that, you can sign up. We're going to be talking a lot this summer about, you know, the various forces at play from, you know, deep red Louisiana to bright blue California. So that's all I'll say there.
All right. Thank you. And we'd love to have you on to talk more about that. Zoya Tierstein is staff writer for Grist. She's covered what Project 2025 would do to climate policy in the U.S. Rachel Cletus is policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She says Project 2025 takes aim at the federal government's ability to address the climate crisis and instead doubles down on actions to worsen it. Rachel and Zoya, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And you can find all of our past shows on Project 2025 at kalw.org. Click News and then Your Call. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.